around $50 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods. Danielle Kadang, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. NCAA tournament, Villanova won its second national title in 3 years with a 79-62 win over Michigan in the NCAA tournament final last night. Major League Baseball, Brewers lose their home opener to St. Louis 8-4. Cubbies shut out 1-0 by Cincinnati. White Sox lost to Toronto 4-2. Those teams all play each other again tonight. In the NBA, the Bucks and Bulls were both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks host Boston. The Bulls host Charlotte. In the NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They're off again tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, April 3rd. Cloudy and windy, light rain cropping up this morning. Then maybe a light rain snow mix for the afternoon, a high of 39. Little heads up for tonight, rain changing to snow, they tell us. Maybe an inch or two of accumulation, a low of 23. Tomorrow, Wednesday, partly sunny and windy, a high of 36. Wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour. This morning, wind from the northeast at 14. It's a gray sky, 36 degrees in Kenosha, 35 degrees in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from UW Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with a new master's in mental health and counseling from Parkside. You can visit uwp.edu for details. And support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back.
And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm pleased to be sitting across from Kara Ernst Schock, who is the director of the next production at the Racine Theater Guild. And it is a title that is probably going to resonate with quite a few of you, The Boxcar Children, which, for those of you who don't know, amounts to sort of a children's book franchise of sorts. And this series is quite beloved, well-known to many people who read it as young people, although I have to plead ignorance. I'm somebody who, one way or another, has managed to miss reading The Boxcar Children. But anyway, for a whole lot of other people, they are excited to see this taking shape on the theatrical stage. And it opens this weekend at the Racine Theater Guild and runs then for...
2 weekends.
For 2 weekends. So you don't want to dawdle if you want to see The Boxcar Children. So Kara Ernst is presiding over this. We're talking in the lobby of the Theater Guild after a rehearsal as part of Tech Week. And this is a demanding week for you and your cast, and especially your crew. And you were telling me that this is an especially complicated show in terms of tech. How so?
There are a lot of various scene changes. We go from the boxcar to an office. We go from the boxcar to another person's backyard. So it's a play that's structured with very short scenes. And so we keep our crew and also our actors on their toes, because not only do they have to know the scenes, they also have to know, where are we going next? And we found that it took us 2 days to get through Act 1 and 2 with all of the scene changes.
Wow. So you're in the midst of getting all of this this put together. So explain the title, The Boxcar Children, and a little bit about this children's book franchise from which all of this springs.
Well, The Boxcar Children is the story of the Alden children. It's two boys and two girls, and they lose their parents in a boating accident. And their youngest brother, Benny, is what everybody keeps saying as slow. It turns out he's actually a brilliant child, but he is considered slow. And so they're going to separate him and send him to a different special school or orphanage while the other ones could go out to foster homes. So they overhear the plans of being separated, and they don't want to be separated. So they run away from the school office as the adults are planning what to do with them now that their parents are gone. And they go running. They make it back to their house to buy some initial supplies. And we see their journey. They set up a couple different camps. And one night, they set up camp not knowing where they are. They wake in the next morning, and there is an old dilapidated boxcar. And they decide that they are going to make this their home.
Wow. So this stage adaptation is of something that was originally not conceived of as a play, is that right?
Or, that's right. It was originally written back in 1924 by Gertrude Chandler Warner. She had written numerous books in the series. It was not meant to go into theater. In fact, the first movie adaptation, I don't know the year of it, but it was actually an animated film that just came out somewhat recently, considering that the novels are so past.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a relatively newer stage adaptation.
Now, are these books that you were familiar with? Did you read them in school?
I didn't. I wasn't familiar with the series until I started teaching middle school. And my co-teacher introduced it to some of our students, and they loved it. And, of course, I brought one of the books home with me, and it was very enjoyable. I won't give out the ending of the play for anybody coming to see it, but the second stories on are kind of a different energy and genre of the original.
Okay. So is this a series of very short books, or almost like a series of short stories around these same characters?
It's mini novels written for middle schoolers. Okay. So it's chapter books.
Right. And what do they feel like as you read them? I mean, are they sort of full of adventure, or are they kind of dramatic and poignant, or are they funny? Or
I think it's a lot of both. They're very well written. We see the struggle that the kids go through. There's some really witty writing as far as the interactions that they have with each other. We definitely have four very distinct personalities in the children that are seen in the book and also on stage, which is really fun to explore with the actors. Yeah. They have to step outside of their box. There's adventures as the series goes on. There's mysteries. And so it's kind of exciting to watch them evolve.
Right. So we're talking about four children. What is the range of their age, both characters and the actors portraying them?
Right. Approximately, Henry is in his early to mid-teens. The actor playing him, Peter, is, I'm going to get it wrong. He's 17. Okay. He is in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Jessie is about 12 years old, and she is played by Lily, who is pretty close in age to that. Violet is 10, who is also played by an actress who is 10. And Benny is 6 in the book. But we, in a way, lucked out. The young gentleman playing him is actually 10 years old. But he has a wonderful sense of youth about him.
Ah.
He is channeling his inner 6-year-old, and I think he's enjoying it very much.
Wow.
But he's a brilliant little actor. They all are. I am so impressed with the children's cast. Usually you hear the nightmare stories of working with children and animals. This cast is top rate, adults through children all the way down. Everybody is a professional from the minute they walk in the building.
Can you just say a word about the challenge of working with young actors? And I know it's something you do a lot of with the various classes you teach here at the Theater Guild for children of various ages. So you're no stranger to the task, and I know you're very good at it. But in your mind, what is the secret to working with young actors, or is it very similar to working with adults as far as you're concerned?
I think it's very similar to working with adults. You have to find the in. What is it that is going to work for that actor, and how are you going to phrase it so that it makes sense to them? Because every single human being on that stage, no matter if they're 10 or no matter if they're 70, they all have a different in. And whether it's approaching it physically, whether it's approaching it emotionally, whether it's approaching it just timing, we need to speed this up, whether we approach it musically, we have to find the in for each individual actor. And again, these actors have been wonderful to work with. They are all experienced. They've had some experience on the stage in some form or another. And they really have a nice sense of their craft, even at such a young age. So the trials and tribulations that can come with a broad age range has not shown its head here. And we also have some younger volunteers backstage on this production as well. And there is no separation between adult and children. Mm-hmm. So everybody is really working hard to bring this production professionally to the stage.
Right. So roughly, what do people experience when they see this? What is sort of the nature of the story that's going to be told? And is this something that's really intended for younger audiences especially, or for anybody?
This is definitely for anyone. The script is actually very simply written. As I read it the first time, the language is very simple. Yes, we see some of the dated language from the 1920s, but it's not hard to understand. But it's such a universal story. It's a story of family. It's a story of developing friendships. It's a story of fighting for the rights of others. It's a story of coming together and creating a family where a family may not exist. And it's also changing the hearts of others who have looked at you not in necessarily a good light in order to come together. So it's very appropriate. I would not hesitate to bring someone as young as a first grader to it, and I would not hesitate to recommend it to all of my older family members, parents, uncles, aunts. I'm looking forward to extending an invitation because I think that they will enjoy it as well, whether or not you know the series.
Right. And how realistic is it? I mean, is it written realistically, or is it more kind of a fanciful adventure with these four children and what they are doing in terms of...
I think it's very realistic. What they are able to do and the resources that they find. We actually, you know, there were a couple kids while we're rehearsing saying, we could totally do this. And there are some adults watching it too going, I totally could have done what they did. I totally would have gone out and found this. I totally could have made that work. And it is very realistic how they make it work. The oldest brother actually manages to go out and get a job. And so he is bringing home money. They're very good at finding what they need. It's written, and it is taking in place during or just slightly after the Depression. So we do run into people where they are struggling. So everybody is feeling that hurt. Everybody is feeling the loss, either monetarily or familial. We meet some other characters who have also had monetary and family love lost. So everybody kind of during this time is going through their own wave. And at one point, one of the characters says, you know, we will feel less lonely knowing that you're here too. And it's kind of a beautiful moment that, yeah, this really could happen. And somehow they come out all right. And that's all I'll say.
Wow. Sounds very intriguing indeed. The Boxcar Children, it opens this Friday, runs two weekends. You can call 633-4218. Or go to racinetheater.org for more information. Cara Ernst, we wish you and your cast and crew the very, very best with the Boxcar Children.
Thank you.
And now it's our time to catch up with the Over Our Head Players, who are headquartered in downtown Racine at the 6th Street Theater and are always doing intriguing, entertaining, and often cutting-edge theater. And their next play, which opens this weekend and runs for the next three weekends, is a play by Stephen Sachs called Bakersfield Mist. And I'm really happy to have two members of the cast with me to talk about Bakersfield Mist, Patty Fitchett and Todd Johnson. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Patty, I got to say, every time I see you, I always say, geez Louise, because I think the very, very first time we had a morning show conversation, you were telling me it was probably 15 years ago at least. Was it a play called Cheese?
Called Cheese Louise,
and,
right.
And you were Cheese Louise?
And yes, I played the titular character, Louise.
Very good. So we are back to talk about a very different play, one that I'm not acquainted with very much, except I know that it springs out of a... sort of an intriguing and amusing real-life incident. So why don't one of you tell us about kind of the core of the story of Bakersfield Mist?
Go ahead.
Well, the play centers on two people. In fact, we are the cast, Patty and I.
The entire cast.
The entire cast. It is based on a real event which recurs from time to time where somebody discovers a forgotten or lost work of art, and there is some kind of controversy about its authenticity. That is at the core of this play, the authenticity of the painting, in this case a painting by Jackson Pollock. Patty plays a Ex bartender?
She's a little rough around the edges. Oh, let's call her that. Yeah.
She's from Bakersfield, California, and I play a character named Lionel Percy, who is an art expert from New York, former director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and so forth and so on. And the play revolves around whether she has discovered a painting worth $50 to $100 million, and. That's how we start.
Yeah. So maybe Patty, you can explain to our listeners, although I'm sure many of them know the name Jackson Pollock, but it is helpful if somebody doesn't know Jackson Pollock and what his work was like, what his paintings looked like, to maybe know a little something about that, because that's really crucial to this story working.
Right, right. Jackson Pollock was sort of the beginning of the modern art movement. His paintings are very not naturalistic at all. They're very splashy and splattery and messy and layered and clumpy and huge. A lot of them were very, very big, but
and completely
abstract. He was very known for his madness of paint application and color, and it was a different turn to the art world. But
right, no bowls,
you know, anybody
no bowls of fruit.
Yeah, anybody who's ever gone to the museum and said, "Oh, you know, my 5-year-old could do that," you know, that may be a Jackson Pollock.
Right. So. And of course, many of his paintings were made with the literal dripping of paint onto a canvas. I mean, that was one of his means to create these still amazing abstract paintings. So tell us the circumstances in this play under which your character, your rough around the edges character, comes in possession of a painting that might possibly be by Jackson Pollock.
Well, she lives in Bakersfield, California, in a trailer, and her trailer is just chock full of all of the treasures that she had found. She's a junk shopper, to the Goodwill, Salvation Army, likes to pick up stuff, and so, you know, all around her house are all the weird little bizarre treasures she's found. But so she's always going to junk shops and stuff, but she goes to one time and she sees a bunch of old paintings, and she's got a friend who has a birthday who's having kind of a rough time, so she's like, well, I'm gonna buy one of those paintings for her as a joke, you know, kind of cheer her up. And so she says, so I looked in the stack for the ugliest one, and I pulled out this god-awful piece of crap, you know, and decides to give it to her friend. The friend doesn't like it, so she says, so I'm stuck with it. And then she tries to sell it in a yard sale, and some art teacher comes up to her and says, hey, you know what? I think this could be. And so that kind of sets her off on a quest, you know, to find out more about art, find out more about the painting, figure out how to get it authenticated, and so it's all part of a quest. So by the time Todd's character comes in, she's been at this for a while, and she's pretty determined that this thing is real, and she's going to get it the respect it deserves.
Right, very good. Todd, tell us more about your character and who he is and what he is like.
Well, he's a New Yorker with a very distinguished background. As I said, he was the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. That's in his past. And in fact, he has a past where there are some secrets he'd rather not have revealed. She has discovered some of those, as we see as the play continues. He's currently serving as a professor at Princeton University, and he works for a foundation. And Patty, along with her brother, sent some money, made a deposit to have somebody come out and investigate this, authenticate it, examine it. And so he shows up, but he is not obviously very eager to be there. And is very skeptical about the potential authenticity of this painting. He's sort of a repressed character. I think of him as being repressed. He's sort of stiff-necked, not very natural. I mean, he's a total contrast with Patty's character, who's very earthy, very naturally natural, very open. He is not. He's all business. He's there to do his job and then get the heck out of there. The world of a trailer park in Bakersfield, California is pretty alien to him.
I should think.
He's from money, and he's from the art community in New York City, of course. So he's very high-toned, very stiff-necked, as I think. And there are things about him that come out in the course of the play. He's a tense person, I think, who unbends as the play goes along because of certain occurrences maybe we shouldn't talk about to give the plot away. But
there may be a bottle or two of Jack Daniels used as props.
Okay, yeah. What a surprise.
Yeah. There's just a little bit of loosening going on there.
Interesting. Mm. So it's a little like if Niles Crane, the little brother of Frasier, wandered into a trailer park for some reason. Much out of his element.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And ran into Daphne's mother.
Oh, there you go. Gotcha.
To follow the Frasier analogy.
Right. And
that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Hard drinking, hard talking, hard-living gal.
Yeah, right. You've probably put your finger on part of what makes this play very special, namely that, although I think you said it consists, at least as far as who we see on the stage, literally just the two of you, the two characters. And, of course, if that's the case, then it needs to be the right combination of characters, or you probably have a play on your hands that really doesn't work. But it sounds like there is exactly the right kind of chemistry between the two, just springing out of the
a kind of
drastic differences
going on between the two of them. They're total opposites, and what they find as the play goes along is that they in fact have a kind of common ground, which probably neither of them would admit as the play begins.
Mm-hmm. and it's been kind of interesting. Todd and I are both long time community theater actors in the area, and circumstances would have meant that neither one of us could really do this show, and some things kind of changed, and these roles fell into our laps, and they are just, it's a lovely, lovely show. Oh, I mean, absolutely. There's a lot of laughs, but there's a lot of things that really make you think about, what is art, who decides what it's worth, what are people, who decides what they're worth.
Right.
It's such a beautiful, beautiful little story.
Yeah.
I think it's a play about appraisals, the way I think of it. He's literally come there to appraise her painting. That's his job, and he takes it very, very seriously, and he's very, very good at it. But as the play evolves, we find out that, of course, they are appraising each other. Mm. They've made an appraisal of each other as they first encountered one another, and that begins to change and shift because of things they find out about each other and because of things that happen as they conflict over the nature of this painting and the worth of it.
Yeah.
And the worth of the painting and the worth of people becomes the issue. It changes from the one to the other. The painting stands in for the human creature, as it were. And,
And it seems to me that a play like this really says something important at this moment in our history when it feels like we've never been more divided, particularly in terms of people on the top and people on the bottom.
Exactly.
And so often we are looking at the others, whoever they are from us, across quite a wide divide. And often there's all kinds of sort of rough, lazy assumptions that get made and so on. Mm-hmm. And it's when we really get to know each other that we start to see the connections and similarities that we would never see at a glance. So.
Yeah, exactly. These two characters could not be from more different worlds, and yet they're very much alike when you look into the heart of the character.
Yeah,
and
it's interesting. I think you brought up the certain social, the present social situation, and the polarization of people, and I think one thing that the play presents so powerfully is that no matter how far divided two people are, if you just kind of sit down and connect and find out what connects you on a human level, you realize that, you know, those two polar opposites are not really all that different.
Not as opposite as we thought.
Right.
I'm thinking that a play like this, I mean, it's not Aida. It's obviously relatively intimate, and it's just the two characters and so on, and you don't need, you know, revolving turntables and so on to put this play on. However, its simplicity in all those ways also means it's a monumental undertaking for the two of you in terms of just number of lines, and I should think the intensity of experience of it being just the two of you. Have you ever been in a play like this in which you are each one of two characters and bearing that much responsibility?
I have had plays as big as this, but I've never had a play where I was just one of two characters that I can recall. There are very few plays that exist that are like that.
Right.
And another factor that makes this even more intimate is that we're doing it in the round, which is my first experience. I think I've done 51 or 52 plays, in my lifetime, but I've never done one in the round.
Huh.
And they've sort of transformed the theater, so when you walk in, you're right there in the trailer. So it's like the whole theater. There's stuff everywhere. Yeah. So you look around and you come through the screen door into the trailer, you know, when you enter into the theater. So it's nice and intimate.
That's
walk right into the midst of her collection of dumpster treasures, and there you are.
Yeah. So do you know how closely this play adheres to the real life story upon which it is based?
I do not.
No, I don't either. I did not even know until Rich Smith gave me a copy of the play and asked me to read it that this play existed. Mm-hmm. I had not ever caught up with it. I was in London when it first came out there in 2014, but I missed it by about 6 days. So, but it's a great discovery for me. It's a revelation. I had no idea it existed. Either.
Right. I guess there's a documentary, and I wish I could say the title of it, but it has the F word right in the middle of it.
Mm,
but
it's, okay.
Who the blank is Jackson Pollock?
Yeah.
Apparently,
okay,
it's a short little documentary about the real life incident. I haven't seen the documentary, but anyway, it points to quite an intriguing story, and it feels like one of those stories that Hollywood would make up, except it's real life. And
there's quite a bit of the Jackson Pollock lore in the show too. I heard Pollock did this, and he did that. He was crazy.
He's rather a legendary character in the art world. So we don't know whether half the stories told about him are true or not.
But they make for great theater. Well, how fun is this?
Yeah, I think it bears mentioning that we have three original paintings that we use in the show, painted by a local woman named Sandy Weiss. She and her husband Mark did these paintings. So we have three very different looking Pollock-esque paintings, and one of them is used on stage every night, and the other two will be on display in the lobby, and there may or may not be a sale of those original works of art after the show closes, but they're really very interesting.
Oh, cool.
Very, very much she obviously did a lot of research, and she's a talented artist in her own right.
Found the look. That's great. What a wonderful tie-in that is as well.
Yeah.
So this play, Bakersfield Mist, opens this weekend. By the way, can you explain the title, Bakersfield Mist?
Well, Bakersfield, of course, is the city in California where it takes place. It derives from the title of one of Pollock's paintings, which is called Lavender Mist.
Oh.
Which exists. It's in the collection of the National Gallery in Washington. And it's quite famous, and it's mentioned in the play.
There you go.
She uses it as an
example.
An example. She uses that to turn the screws on him just a little bit.
She's done her homework.
She has, in fact, done her homework, yes.
And how interesting, it's not only that you're, in a sense, probing into her alien world, but she's been probing into your alien world.
Yeah.
And
there's a wonderful moment where the play turns, where she mentions that she has Googled him, and she asks, has he ever Googled himself? And he responds that he has not, and she says that she has Googled him and that he has quite a past. And that puts him on edge because there are a couple of things there that he would rather not have known.
Wow.
So,
very good. Before we give people ticket information, one thing that we should talk about, because we just about always need to talk about this if we're talking about the overhead players.
What do I think I know is coming up? Yeah.
So how adult is this play in terms of its language and subject matter? I mean,
the subject matter, not so much, but the language, yeah, this is definitely a...
pretty salty play.
Yes, absolutely, right. Absolutely.
And it sounds like it needs to be. I mean,
I
mean,
it really helps to, because the New York guy who comes in and hears this salty language is, you know, it's part of what makes his eyes pop out.
Right,
he's
absolutely.
In the room with this
yeah,
woman,
it just has
know.
To be there. I mean, as someone who scarcely says even the remotest, swear word. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a big fan of it in real life, but I really don't mind it in a play when it has to be there, when the characters would not be authentic without it. I mean,
like when we went to see Hamilton?
Yeah, right, exactly. There you go.
There's a couple of them in there, too.
Yeah, right. No.
She's a very in-your-face kind of character, and that is, and I mean, that's established from the moment the play begins. It begins with a bang, almost literally. And,
and you know, although, you know, at the Overhead Players, we don't necessarily seek out scripts with bad language in them, but we don't shy away from them either.
No. Right. And that's perfectly fine. It's
some people watch ABC, some people watch HBO.
Right.
So there's
there's
room for both.
Absolutely,
We're propelled really into an examination of the interior of two characters, you know, and so the rough language occasionally is meant to augment that, rather than be, you know, front and center.
Right. Yeah. It's not there for gratuitousness Well, good. It's just good to be able to talk about that.
Yeah.
So it opens this weekend, runs for 3 weekends, so you have an exhausting gauntlet ahead of you.
Correct. Yeah, we do two shows on Saturday nights, too,
So what do people do if they want to have tickets? Of course, the 6th Street Theater, it's a wonderful little space, but it's a little space, so should people be getting their tickets ahead of time, do you think?
Oh, definitely, yeah. If you want tickets, just go to overourheadplayers.org or call the box office at 632-6802. Leave a message. Somebody will call you back. We're very lucky with the Overhead Players. We've got a lot of rabid season ticket holders. Mm-hmm. So we're lucky that, you know, as soon as we open a show, we're guaranteed to, you know, have a good crowd. And we do only seat about 65 to 70 in the show for this, in the theater for this show. But I would definitely, there's one or two shows that are sold out, but I think most of the rest of the shows have plenty of tickets available.
Very good. So again, this is Bakersfield Mist by Stephen Sachs. It opens this weekend and runs for the next 3 weekends at the 6th Street Theater in downtown Racine, presented by the Over Our Head Players. And Patty Fitchett and Todd Johnson, great to talk with you today about this most intriguing play. And very best wishes to you for this entire run.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much.
And the time is 8:43, and it's time for part three of today's morning show here on WGTD. Tomorrow, you're going to be hearing most of an interview that I recorded yesterday morning with Dr. Catherine Kramer, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of a very, very significant book called The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness and the Rise of Scott Walker. By the way, she is coming to the University of Wisconsin-Parkside a week from tomorrow, Wednesday, April 11th, for a public presentation, and we'll hear more about that tomorrow, and we'll be hearing from a UW-Parkside professor who is also going to be part of that special evening. Professor Kramer, between 2007 and 2012, engaged in a very interesting study of rural voters in Wisconsin, trying to figure out, in a sense, what makes them tick. How do they see the world? How do they process political choices? And what sorts of attitudes and concerns were at the heart of the choices that they were making? Here's a portion of our conversation in which she explains how she went about doing this, and in particular, how she went about seeking out the groups of Wisconsin rural voters whom she spoke to over the course of the 5 years.
In 2007, I was really interested in the way social class affects how we think about politics. And by that, I mean just people's sense of where they sit in the pecking order of things in terms of haves and have-nots. And I also, as you can probably tell from my accent, I've been here a long time. I love this state very much. And so I decided I'm going to study the way social class affects how people interpret politics. And I'm going to do it in this place that I love, the great state of Wisconsin. So I used Wisconsin sort of out of convenience, to be honest. And I sampled communities from across the state because I knew I was going to invite myself into groups of regulars, people who meet on a basically a daily basis just to visit with one another. And I figured if I sampled some small places and some more urban places and a wide range of places in between, I would get a range of people in terms of their own perceptions of their social class. So I was not looking for a rural versus urban divide. And in retrospect, you know, it's a little bit embarrassing to say I'd lived here pretty much my whole life and didn't really know it existed.
Hmm. So you really came to understand it through the course of this study that you did over the course of 5 years. I find that really intriguing, and I also appreciate your honesty, because there's probably some people in your line of work who would probably find a way to sort of buffer that reality somehow and paint it in such a picture, and you're not afraid to say, I didn't understand this. I didn't see this coming. It was, in a sense, unfolding right under my nose, and I, along with most people, did not really understand the nature of this rural consciousness.
I mean, that's so true. It really is just a sign of the nature of this divide, and that, you know, you talk to people who've spent a good chunk of their life in a more rural place, and they kind of laugh and say, this is new to you? You know, that people in smaller communities and rural places are kind of resentful toward the cities. How can this be new to you? But clearly, I think the reception of my book, it's just a sign that so many people who really are unfamiliar with rural life had no clue that this kind of sentiment was out there and that it was so politically relevant.
Hmm. Before we talk about how you went about doing this study, because that's one of the things I found especially fascinating in your book, I want to give you an opportunity to spell out sort of the three fundamental elements that comprise this thing that you choose to call rural consciousness, which would be, in a sense, this rurally based attitude of resentment that you think has been a very powerful driving force in the way that many rural Americans, and certainly rural Wisconsinites in particular, have sort of understood the world around them and made certain political choices. What are several hallmarks of this rural consciousness?
Sure. So rural consciousness is just a fancy social science term for something pretty simple, which is, as you say, it's this sense of being a rural person, kind of in what we would call an identity as a rural person, which doesn't mean that people are walking around saying, I identify as a rural Wisconsinite. It's, you know, it comes out as people saying to each other, people around here, people in places like this. But it's this strong, you know, sense of I'm a person of this place. I'm a person of a rural place. And the rural consciousness is that, combined with this sense that I'm on the short end of the stick. People like me in places like this, we don't get our fair share. And yes, they were talking primarily about three main things. They were saying to me, we don't get our fair share of attention, we don't get our fair share of resources, and we don't get our fair share of respect. And very briefly, I'll give you some examples of that. So we don't get our fair share of attention was basically the sense that, you know, all the decisions are made in Madison or in Milwaukee, and they're communicated out to us, and we're regulated by people in distant places who don't understand what our lives are like and the challenges that we face. And then they also had a perception that they weren't getting their fair share of resources, primarily taxpayer money, because they had, again, a sense that Madison sucks in all the taxpayer dollars, spends them on itself or on Milwaukee, and they just don't see that money coming back to their community. And finally, and probably most importantly, I think, in light, just looking back on the 2016 presidential election, was the sense that we don't get what we deserve in terms of respect. Meaning people were saying to me, those folks making all the decisions that affect our lives, that rule our lives, they don't know us and they don't understand us and they don't actually even like us. They think we're uneducated and unsophisticated and racist and sexist and homophobic and Islamophobic, and we're mad about it.
And all that bundled together creates this sense of resentment, rural-based resentment that has been such a powerful driving force. And I think one thing that is interesting that you say about this resentment is that there are two factors of it that are important for us to acknowledge, namely that this resentment is public and it is stubborn. Explain what you mean by both. I mean, we all know what those words mean, public and stubborn, but what do they mean in this context?
Well, resentment is a kind of emotion or sentiment that it's okay to say out loud. It's social psychologists have compared it to, say, jealousy or envy, which sometimes reflects poorly on the feeler, the person with the emotion. But resentment is something that it tends to be the case that people are okay sharing with the other people around them. And that both, I mean, that is one way in which it can be politically really useful, because you can talk about it and you can draw attention to it. You can say, you're right, you're not getting your fair share and you're right to be upset. And it also, it's stubborn in that it takes a long time to change such a sentiment, because partly because it's very much rooted in perception. So, and by that I mean, I'm sure some of your listeners are saying right now, yeah, but it's not the case that they don't actually get their fair share of resources. And it actually is the case that rural communities on a per capita basis get a little bit more of state taxpayer dollars and a little bit more of federal taxpayer dollars than people in urban areas. But that doesn't matter on some level for the sentiment of resentment. It's driven by perceptions, and it's hard to turn. It takes a long time to turn those perceptions around.
So for instance, here in Wisconsin, you were saying that even when, for instance, public employees suffered what amounted to a pretty painful and significant reversal of their fortune, so to speak, that didn't wipe away these feelings of resentment, at least among a lot of the people that you talked about.
That's for sure, right? Because now, I mean, let's say, for example, public school teachers in communities across the state. Now, is it suddenly the case that people are saying, okay, now the balance is evened out a bit, and now they're paying more into the collective pot, and so we're not resenting them anymore? That really hasn't happened. I mean, I still hear the tune of they have summers off, they still have, you know, pensions, and people still feeling like public employees in in the smaller communities around the state have a better quality of life, are more well off than private employees. And that I still hear that sentiment.
So that resentment has real staying power, and that's important for us to understand. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Catherine Kramer, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we are talking about her very important book called The Politics of Resentment. Back to the way in which you went about studying this. As you've already touched on, between 2007 and 2012, you traveled all around the state of Wisconsin to speak to small informal groups, and for the most part spoke with small informal groups that would themselves sort of self-convene on a very regular basis. So this would be kind of the curmudgeons in the corner at Burger King that meet every morning over coffee to discuss the world, and And sometimes groups of women speaking at a family style restaurant, and in many cases groups that were kind of a mixture, and all around the state. Was it just mathematics that made you want to talk and listen to Wisconsinites in these group settings? I mean, was it an efficient way to hear from more of them, or was there something about the group dynamic that also drew you to this possibility?
I was definitely interested in the group dynamic because I had learned over time that when you listen to people talk with the folks that they know and that they're used to talking with, you can see a lot more of how people draw on their sense of who they are in the world and the kind of people that they are to interpret politics. And that's identity. That's the, you know, people using a sense of, so what kind of person am I? What kind of beliefs are appropriate for someone like me? And as people have conversations with one another about politics, you can sort of hear them asking each other those questions and making claims about, you know, oh, people like us, we don't support this type of person or that type of policy. We don't hold this kind of value. And so I'm really interested in political conversations within groups.
Explain how you went about finding these groups, because we're talking about communities in the far-flung corners of the state, and I'm sure in many cases, probably in most cases, communities you yourself had never visited, maybe communities you'd never even heard of before. Logistically, how did you go about tracking down these groups?
Sure. Well, I started out by printing off a bunch of maps of different characteristics of the state, just economic, political, agricultural, demographic in terms of ethnic heritage and racial composition. And looking across all those maps, I basically wanted to confirm that there's certain areas of the state, you know, yes, there's a Fox River Valley. Yes, there's a northwest corner that's distinctive. Green Bay is somewhat unique unto itself, et cetera. And then in each of those places, I sampled at least one big place and one small place. And then when I had sampled communities across the state, there were, 27 in all. I called up local newspaper editors and people in county extension offices in our awesome UW Extension Service. And I just said, you know, where in such and such Wisconsin do people get together on a regular basis that I might get access to, that I could invite myself into? And sometimes they weren't sure what I was talking about. And then I would say, you know, like, is there a diner in town where there's a group of people? Oh, sure. I know, you know, and sometimes people knew exactly what I was talking about. And, basically they ended up referring to me, as you said, basically morning, coffee clutches of people who get together pretty much every day. And, you know, gas stations were really commonplace, and diners and restaurants. And sometimes I had to get a little bit more creative, spend time in places of worship or ask more people in the community. Sometimes it took a while and people were meeting in more private places. But I basically asked people in the communities who I figured knew those places really well.
Professor Catherine Kramer. She is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and her very interesting book called The Politics of Resentment has been a very significant work read with great interest across the country. And Professor Kramer is going to be coming to the University of Wisconsin-Parkside a week from tomorrow, Wednesday, April 11th. We're going to be playing more of this conversation on tomorrow's morning show. We're also going to be hearing from Professor Peggy James from UW Parkside, who has embarked with some students on an interesting study of her own that, to some extent at least, springs out of the work that Professor Kramer has done. On Thursday, postponed from last Thursday, Rachel Simmons, the author of the book Enough As She Is, how to help girls move beyond impossible standards of success to live healthy, happy, and fulfilled lives. And on Friday, we'll spend part of the morning with the author of a really interesting book called The Socrates Way. We look back at Socrates, who he was, and some of the central tenets of his philosophy. And the author talks about some of the ways in which the wisdom of Socrates can make